just a memory to me now. Memory to me now. So long, you are so gone. Just a memory to me now. Memory to me now.
You're listening to 90.3 KFAI FM, Minneapolis, St. Paul, online and archived at kfai.org.
The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them and are not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
You're listening to KFAI on 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and streaming on the web at kfai.org. Welcome to Right On Radio.
Hi, folks. My name is Emma. Here in the studio today, I have Kristen Stawell, the lyricist and composer, and Maria Bartholdi, the playwright and lyricist, for Endometriosis, the musical, which is currently playing at Theater and Around, which is right across the street from our KFAI studio. Welcome to the show, Kristen and Maria.
Thank you for having us.
Yay. All right. So just a couple of questions. Can you give me a definition of what is endometriosis for our listeners on the air?
We sure can. Endometriosis is, it gets its name from endometrial tissue, which is tissue found in the uterus. But endometriosis is when tissue that is similar to that type of tissue grows elsewhere in the body. So it's a full body disease. It's not just a reproductive disease. It can grow anywhere. It has been found in the brain, on eyeballs, in, you know, commonly in lungs or diaphragm, most commonly in the abdomen, in the pelvis, that sort of area. But it can be anywhere. It's an inflammatory disease. That the cause is unknown, the cure is unknown. Right now, the gold standard treatment is excision surgery. And after you get, you know, disease excised, you could need to have that again later on, maybe not. There's just a lot that's not known about it yet. Maria, anything else to add?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a very common disease. It affects 1 in 10 people who menstruate, which is about 200 million people worldwide. And the truth is, not a lot of people know what endometriosis is. Most people haven't even heard the word. And the medical community, the research community, it's like severely underfunded and under-researched and under-known, quite frankly, by a lot of people, include the medical community included. So that's one of the things we were trying to do with this musical that we wrote, was try to raise awareness about the disease. It manifests so differently for lots of people who have it. So for some people, they might have these types of symptoms. For some people, they might have completely different symptoms, but they all have endometriosis. So the hallmark symptom is excruciatingly painful periods, but not everybody has that. Both Kristen and I have endometriosis. For me, it manifested that way, pelvic pain, the fact that I got sore sitting in chairs for more than 30 minutes, because it can affect pain in your legs, pain in my ankles, fatigue, sensitive, like getting sick all the time because your nervous system is just overloaded with inflammation, that kind of thing. So it's very tricky, right? It's different for everybody, but it can be very debilitating. And it takes on average 12 years to be diagnosed and 7 doctors, which for me is unacceptable.
Yeah. All right. So I'm guessing like the big inspiration for this play was because you both have endometriosis. Is that correct? Did I misheard that?
No, that is correct. Okay. And we had been wanting to collaborate on a project, and Maria actually didn't know she had endometriosis until a few months ago. She was finally diagnosed. And yeah, that kind of just is you know, she first went to the doctor for painful periods 27 years ago. So that's kind of tells you, I just have a lot of passion about this because it is so common. I think when someone goes to the doctor with that symptom, that should be the first thing they think it is. And it shouldn't take more than one visit to, you know, investigate that. But 27 years later, Maria's now diagnosed with endometriosis and is learning exactly how much it's infiltrated her life and the things she could do.
What's interesting too is, is that, like, not only is it do a lot of people who have this disease not get support from the medical community when we raise our voices about it, but also I was gaslighting myself about it, right? Because we're taught from such a young age that it's totally normal to have painful periods, right? To just like suffer for a week out of the month and have it impact your life. When honestly, that's not normal. And you deserve to live a pain-free, productive life without something like your period completely setting you back every single month. So I just wanted to add that, like, you know, it's just ingrained in us culturally, I think, to accept this as women when we really shouldn't have to. Okay, go on, Kristen.
Oh, yeah. To answer your question, why did we write this musical? all of those things to, you know, we want to educate. We want to be advocates. We want, you know, when I was first diagnosed 8 years ago now, I had a lot of stories of going to the doctor, and I would talk to other women, and everyone, no matter what they were dealing with, had similar stories of just kind of maybe being dismissed or not taken too seriously or not offered pain management, you know, just things like that, that it's kind of a typical woman's experience at the doctor, no matter what you're there for. So we thought, wow, this is really actually universal. Like 10% is a lot of the population, but really everyone has experienced this in the healthcare system, whether they have these symptoms or not. So we really want to bring attention to it and you know, advocate and support people going through this kind of thing.
Yeah, I don't have endometriosis, but I know I do have family members who did. I know a lot of folks with uteruses in my personal family who struggle with PCOS or a lot of anything with that kind of female reproductive organs issues, and the constant doctors, the constant dismissal, and just like, oh, you know, it's just your period. You have to tolerate it. You have to just endure it. That's what I really liked about this musical was it mentions it. It's just not something I've ever heard of in terms of like a play, a musical, or even a piece of media. I'm just curious, how did you two end up meeting? In general,
we met in the first grade. We've been best friends our whole lives. Did Brownie Scouts together, and you know, from then on, have been creating stuff together. We had a garage band in middle school. And high school, we did, gosh, I don't know, so many different creative projects together. There was a local TV station in our town, and I remember Maria's mom would rent a video camera from there, and we would make a home video, like what we thought were very professional home videos. And we've always been making stuff together, sometimes musical, sometimes theatrical, and now as adults, this is our first project that we've been pursuing together.
Awesome. So can you just give us an overview of the tone and vibe of the musical for those who missed it at Fringe a couple of years ago, for those who haven't yet to see it live?
Oh my gosh, yes. So I think, I know we've been talking very serious here in this interview, but this is a very fun show. I think that we just both we have a big attachment to comedy in our lives. Like, I'm an improv comedian. Kristen is very, very funny and plays piano for improv groups out in DC. And I think we just both knew that that was where we were going to end up, is like we were just drawn to this topic and making it fun, accessible, and funny, because that's the kind of people we are. And I think, you know, honestly, just if you took this so super seriously, you would just be like, I just can't handle it. It's a horrible, debilitating disease. But when you can't cry anymore about it, you laugh, right? And so the tone of the show is very fun and upbeat. It's an absurdist comedy, so it's extremely silly and dumb. We have songs like called, for example, Dear Aunt Flo. We have people wearing costumes you might not expect at a musical. The show goes in a lot of really weird, zany directions, and we love that about it. The absurdity of the show, I like to say as well, is an interesting mirror to our lead character. Her name is Jane, to her life, I think, because it really does feel absurd if you're a person who has this disease or any disease really, and you found trouble in the medical system, because, you know, you're living with this reality that other people refuse to accept. And I think our show in an interesting way does that as well, as the reality is absurd around Jane, but her condition and the way she, you know, needs it to be treated with respect and dignity just doesn't happen. And so I like that parallel that we have in the show with the absurdist comedy and the absurdity of people not taking the serious condition seriously.
Awesome. Just kind of a follow-up with The Fringe. So it did premiere in Fringe, Minnesota Fringe Festival in 2022, and it was a big hit. It sold out on all 5 showings, correct?
Oh gosh, I don't know if it sold out on all of them, but it was pretty close if it yeah. didn't.
And it did take home, I believe, the venue pick, the audience pick, and the artist pick. And so the Fringe Fest, from my understanding, it was a 45-minute play. And then now what's currently shown at Theater and Around is a 2-hour production with about like a 15-minute intermission. So what was the thought process of going from the Fringe show to the full-fledged production over at Theater and the Round? And what was like the creative process? What did you add? What are things you had to cut just kind of elaborate on? How was that creative
sure.
process?
Yeah. The Fringe, the 2022 Fringe had a 50-minute time limit. So we gave ourselves a 45-minute time limit, hoping people would laugh. And so... even from the first day of Fringe rehearsal to that production, we cut a lot of stuff. So we already had stuff that we had to cut just for time, like, you know, a full song that had 3 verses and choruses, maybe just had 1 verse and chorus in the Fringe version, that sort of thing. So when we always kind of knew we wanted this to have a life beyond Fringe, and we knew we wanted to expand some things. The biggest change is the ending. The Fringe version was really short. The ending, we get to find out like, oh, this is the problem. And it's just kind of, you know, like, hooray. And really that, I think there is a hooray getting diagnosed with this disease is wonderful, because you know, and you can then, you know, figure out what to do about your symptoms. But the problem with this disease is it's a chronic illness. It's not a take this pill and it's better, or even surgery and it's better. It's, you know, you have to really trial and error, basically. What works for one person, kind of like the symptoms, what works for one person doesn't work for someone else. So there's always different things you have to be trying, and, you know, what your diet, your lifestyle, surgeries, all of that. So we wanted to have an ending that was a little more honest about that. And it is still a good thing to be diagnosed, but what is the reality of now living with this diagnosis? So that's kind of the biggest thing we changed, is we elaborated on that a lot. The Fringe version had 6 actors in it. Now there are 8 actors. So we've added a couple of characters. The ensemble all play multiple characters. So really we've added like 6 or 7 characters, with 2 actors. Some of the songs are longer. There are a lot of brand new songs. Some scenes, we didn't have time for a song in the Fringe version. Now there's a song and things like that. So I think, you know, it's been 3 years since that Fringe, and we've been working on it that whole time. And we're really happy. Even now, we were meeting the other day and talking about like, okay, here's what we might still want to change. Here's where we might actually elaborate a little more on this topic or that topic. So we're still, it's just kind of always a work in progress for us, which makes it really exciting, but I think where it is right now does feel final, and like we've landed in a really great place. And if given the opportunity, you know, we'll make changes here and there, but yeah.
I don't know, Maria, do you have any other comments to add to that, or?
Oh, sure. I'll add that. One thing too is that the show is very timely. So we have a section in the show which was built in specifically to address current events, because we know, you know, when we know that technically the subject matter is rather narrow. We're talking about endometriosis, a very specific disease, but it's also extremely broad because, like Kristen mentioned earlier, there's so many people who have gone to the doctor and been dismissed, or whose problems haven't been taken seriously by their family or their work, their job, and won't give them time off, that kind of stuff. So it is broad in that sense. But we also wanted to address all of the other stuff that is part of the ecosystem of healthcare and marginalized people trying to seek care for their health care, which, of course, is relevant to Jane and her journey. But the show, of course, focuses on Jane. She's the main character. But we wanted to give a moment to be like, she doesn't exist in a vacuum, right? All of this other stuff is happening around and outside her and to her. And her life is the way it is because of all that as well. So that's something that we're attuned to in the version of the show. Like, if you see it now, there you'll know this section that I'm talking about with women who are in a waiting room at a doctor's office, and there's stuff that we had to change, honestly, like 3 days or whatever, I think, before the show had its first performance, because the news is really changing that quickly, and we don't know what's going to happen in the next few months, the next few years, what new horrors await us, but we're happy to, you know, go in there and make those changes, because I think the show just needs to stay up to the moment and relevant with how that stuff is impacting people's lives. And I like that about it, that we are able to take that time and moment and widen out our lens a little bit. We're thankful to Theater in the Round for giving us the opportunity to transform the piece from 45 minutes into the 90-minute version, which was a reading we did at Theater in the Round. Shannon Custer, who directed the show in this production, was our mentor for that and helped us expand the piece from 45 to 90 minutes. It quite honestly, it was one of the hardest things that I personally have ever had to do, because, you know, in my head, even though we wanted a life beyond Fringe, it was like we wrote it for Fringe. So a lot of it felt very fringy to me. And I was like, I'm not sure how to make it, I don't know what the word is, to expand it in a way that makes sense for a full scale musical. But that it was also such a wonderful challenge and taught us so much about the show and ourselves as creators, that when we did it, it was just extremely rewarding. And so I'm really proud of where we ended up now with this full length version. But like Kristen said, we were just meeting the other day and I was like, ooh, what if we did X, Y, and Z now? And I think, you know, that's just kind of the truth of this show, is that it's got flexibility in it, because Jane's journey is in a way tied to the world that we live in currently. And I like that I mean, this is the first time we've seen it fully produced, right? So also you're going to see stuff that you, when you write it on a page, you have no idea really how it's going to be performed by actors on a stage. And so, you know, we have all that wonderful knowledge now too, that we'll be able to use moving forward.
Yeah. Actually, one of my questions here is, it's about the current administration, which is very hostile to healthcare for those, especially in marginalized communities. I know when I saw the musical first, I always thought it was like kind of a soft protest and like kind of an affirmation to those who do experience those symptoms, whether or not it's just endometriosis or PCOS. And I kind of almost took the musical as like an emotional validating, especially it is kind of so whimsical. And I do think it is a very important musical for this current time period that we are in. So how do you have any more thoughts on that, or?
Yeah, I think we can just give a really specific example. The scene Maria was talking about, we had a song in the Fringe version called Birth Control that was really about the overprescribing of birth control. Like, it feels like for many women, you go to the doctor with any symptom related to your period and the answer is hormonal birth control. That'll solve it. And so it's the song was about that and how, you know, these things are not actually helping us. And we were, you know, investigating the musical recently for this production, like, what do we want to update? And it feels like currently the over-prescribing of birth control is not the biggest problem with birth control. It felt like, you know, like but not having access to it is a way bigger problem. So we've reworked that entire scene and song to be a lot more about that, about how birth control is currently. Because 3 years ago, it did feel like, oh gosh, now I have to take birth control. And we also feel like birth control is wonderful and we're glad it exists. Like we don't want to suggest that we don't feel like that. But today it feels like, wow, like people can be denied birth control for what I would consider is no reason. And so we want to bring light to that and the kind of dangers around that instead. The song's now called Birth, in parentheses, Control.
Yes. Birth control. I really love puns and plays on words, probably a little too much as somebody who's done some of the lyrics in the show. So I was very proud of myself for putting birth in parentheses and control after it, because the song is really, you know, now more generally about the control of femme people and how, or marginalized people of marginalized genders, and how people outside of us in our own bodies seek to control us through medicine and through, you know, the legal system or whatever. And it really makes me happy to hear that you thought of the show as a protest, because I think of it that way too. So thank you.
Perfect. My next kind of question is, it's a little silly, but do you have any favorite songs that you loved writing or that you thought was like really cathartic? Can you explain more of the creative process? Because I always like talking to lyricists and like how they write and just songs in general.
Well, I'll go first because I really am excited to talk about this. My favorite song in the show is a song called TMI, which did not exist in the Fringe version, but we had kind of a very, very different version that we had written that didn't end up in the Fringe. And so it kind of got sidelined. And when we did the 90-minute version, we're like, well, what if we thought of a way to bring this back? And it's a song that's within a scene that's set in Applebee's, where Jane is having dinner with her family. And her family doesn't want to talk about her problems because they're very uncomfortable. And I think as Minnesotans, a lot of us can relate to that sentiment. We have trouble talking about hard things, I think. And so TMI is essentially the family just kind of deflecting and trying not to talk about Jane's problem in any way, shape, or form. So it includes a ton of euphemisms for period. And Kristen lives in Washington, D.C. most of the time. So we collaborate virtually over Zoom and stuff. And for that song, she was here as we were trying to develop the 90-minute version. And we got to write that song together in person. And it was one of the greatest experiences because it just flowed. Like, it was just so easy. I always say I feel like that song was done in 15 minutes. It was probably more than that, but that's what it felt like, because it just came to us like divine inspiration, which is a very funny thing to say if you hear the song, because it is filthy, but which plays to my personal strengths. But I love that song, and it was so easy to write, and it was just a wonderful experience.
I agree with that. Writing that song together in person was, it got done really quickly, but also was in danger of never getting done because we were just cracking ourselves up the entire time. Usually our writing process with the songs is I'll probably write something first with what I call nonsense lyrics, really placeholder lyrics, where it's like, okay, I'm too much of a perfectionist. So if I really worry about the lyrics, the song's never going to get done. So I'm like, okay, this is basically what we wanted to say. I send the song to Maria. She writes more lyrics, and then together we refine from there. Or maybe, you know, one of us has thought of lyrics and we've gone back and forth on that before there's music, that sort of thing. But it's really a back and forth. So to be doing it together at the same time was really fun and special, especially for that song, which is just so comedic and absurd, that to have that interaction made it, you know, so much easier to write than just to be on our own and then getting feedback afterwards. Because I'm a perfectionist, I also don't mind working alone sometimes, so I can go very, very slowly. my favorite song in the show, I don't know. There's a song, Theater in the Round wanted an intermission, and we hadn't really built the show for that. And we're like, oh, okay. So where the intermission falls naturally, there's a great place for it. But kind of the next scene is not super upbeat. We're like, we want a splashier act two opener. So we wrote a new act two opener. And I think honestly, whatever song we wrote most recently is my favorite, and that's the one we wrote most recently.
I love that.
Yes, but that we had originally, written a few different songs to open the show, and where we landed one, we ended up refining, and we got exactly where we wanted. But that means that a song that we really liked wasn't in the show anymore, just because there wasn't a place for it. So we got to put a little bit of it in the Act Two opener, and I'm really quite pleased with that.
Oh yeah, it's great. You gotta see the Act Two opening. It might be one of my favorite moments of the show itself.
All right, I just have one more question, and it is: where would you like to see the play go? Once its final run's going to be coming up pretty soon, towards the middle of July, where would you want to take this musical?
Was Broadway.
Broadway.
That's a great question, and I think we don't totally know the answer. Like I said before, one of our goals with the show is advocacy and education, and so we do want it to have more of a life, and we want it to speak to more people than just the people of Minneapolis. But yeah, Theater in the Round has been so supportive of us, and we are so grateful to be doing the world premiere at that show with those specific people. Like, we love everyone there. We love the cast, the director, the musicians. We're so happy with this production. And I think what's next is a little up in the air right now. I think we both know, like, little things that we're like, okay, I want to add this or change that. And that's really exciting. So figuring out the right venue to do those sort of things in, I think, is part of the adventure.
Yeah, I would love to see this show produced again. I don't want this to be the end for it. I think it suffers from the fact that I think a lot of people are turned off by the idea of seeing a show that's quote unquote for women, that's quote unquote about a disease or whatever. So it does have that hurdle to jump that, for instance, Oklahoma might not have. But I feel like once people get past that and actually see the show, they understand that it is a universal experience. It is really, really funny. Like, a lot of people tell me they're just crying when they're laughing during the show, which makes me so happy. The songs are incredible. I just want people to understand and get past that initial barrier and give the show a chance. And I think when they do, they find out they really love it. So I'd love to see it put up on its feet somewhere again and again, quite honestly.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Kristen and Maria, for joining us in at KFAI 90.3 FM. Endometriosis the Musical runs through July 13th with performances Fridays and Saturdays at 7:30 p.m. and Sundays at 2 p.m., a special Thursday performance on July 10th, and a Pay What You Can night on Monday, June 30th. Tickets can be found on the website at theaterintheround.org.
Support for KFAI comes from the Parkway Theater presenting Pure Prairie League Thursday, July 10th.
The country rock band known for its hits like Falling In and Out of Love, Let Me Love You Tonight, and Amy are back with an all-new album, Back on Track.
AmericanaHighways.org calls Back on Track a well-thought-out menu of fine songs and performances that still retain the Pure Prairie League potency and poignancy.
And their album cover mascot, Sad Luke, is back too. For more information about Pure Prairie League at the Parkway Theater, is available at theparkwaytheater.org.
Listening to KFAI on 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and streaming on the web at kfai.org. Welcome to Right on Radio.
Neil and his wife Carol were a couple of years on the land, a pristine oceanfront slice of Nova Scotia's North Shore, with so good they look fake sunsets, a bunky cottage, and nary a drip of running water, before they decided to design and build the Privy. Before that, it was a roll of Charmin and a walk into the woods. The outhouse was a project for Neil and his soon-to-be son-in-law, Scott, a carpenter, restorer, and Canada Green Building Council certified project manager. Scott knows his game, and the finished product, backed by Neil's unfettered enthusiasm, is a thing of beauty. At least until I tromp inside and pee all over the floor. An outhouse is basically a protected hole in the ground for human excrement. Culturally speaking, even aesthetically speaking, there's not a whole lot of variation on the design. But Neil and Scott did a lot more than build a box platform on concrete and give it four walls and a door. This outhouse has upmarket khaki-colored clapboard and plenty of natural light from a little crank window that looks out on spruce trees. The inside walls are pristine white, the door carved wood with a brass lion knocker, a wedding gift to Neil and Carol in 1980. There's even a magazine rack and paperbacks. But Neil and Scott have only ever peed with penises. And without having consulted any vagina owners, their gorgeous little outhouse has one fatal flaw. Men in Neil's outhouse stand and aim into the hole. Women sit. I may have to tell you, depending on the depth of your urethra knowledge, that men can point urine in any direction they fancy. Not women. Our urine exits the body at roughly 45 degrees ahead of us. We gain a little tinkle wiggle room by shifting forward or backward in any position, but whether we're sitting, standing, or crouching, pee exits our bodies roughly halfway to the horizon. As I sat down to take that calamitous first pee in Neil's outhouse, resting on the comfortable wooden seat, magazine in hand, my urine hit the inside front wall of the seat's plywood box. It streamed down until it reached the spot where the box sits on top of the brand new floor. I tipped up the bottom of my magazine and craned my neck to peek between my knees. Oh, I thought, oh dear. I watched, horrified and quite unable to move enough to solve the problem, as my pee pooled into a puddle beneath my Birkenstocks. Men hit the back, Neil told me later. Women hit the front. Now it's fixed. Neil installed a piece of plastic that diverts women's urine into the hole. Neither Neil nor Scott had built an outhouse before, but I don't blame this design flub on their inexperience. I blame it on the myth of the universal user. See, Neil and Scott were designing a space for men and for women, and for children, and for the elderly, and for a whole smattering of other users who might pop by for a cup of tea and need the can before they get back on the road. And while they probably didn't approach the job talking about designing for men alone, they also didn't approach it thinking enough about women. Toilets are so run-of-the-mill that the need for them so commonplace, a human goes to the bathroom about 2,500 times a year. They somehow get lost in the folds of our consciousness. I get how it happens. We all have to go, and we all go through roughly the same range of activities, take down clothing, get into position, excrete, wash up, to do it. By this logic, it's no big deal to design a toilet. You just have to refer to your own experience. Except, as my creeping pee puddle shows, that experience is usually a man's. Because the majority of architects, planners, designers, manufacturers, and outhouse builders, I'd wager, though I haven't been able to dig up stats on that, are men. These professionals and semi-professionals aren't blind to the extraordinary needs of some. After all, wheelchair users fought and have won to have specially outfitted stalls, and most bathrooms have changing tables for children in diapers. But the needs of women are hidden and nuanced. No one knows when a particular woman is menstruating. There's no specific calculus for tallying up how much longer it takes women to negotiate the greater amount of clothing we must pull down or up to seat ourselves on a toilet. Neil and Scott weren't up to date on the position of my urethra, clearly. See, women have different needs, but not such visible or glaringly different needs that people are shaken into counting them. That's what makes toilets particularly a woman's issue. Bathrooms aren't neutral spaces, and there is no universal user. Their design is loaded with pitfalls, not least of all the occasional puddle of urine, and their accessibility is loaded, too, with meaning. It has been this way for hundreds and hundreds of years.
Wonderful. You were just listening there to Leslie Lowe reading from her book that's coming out in September, No Place to Go, How Public Toilets Fail Our Private Needs. Welcome to Ride on Radio, Leslie Lowe.
Thank you so much for having me.
Leslie Lowe is a freelance journalist and journalism instructor based in Halifax, Nova Scotia. I love that town. She's been recognised for her long form journalism by the Canadian Association of Journalists and the Atlantic Journalism Awards. She holds an MFA in creative nonfiction from the University of King's College, where she also teaches in the journalism department.
All true.
So it's very obvious why you wrote this book, but tell us a little bit more about how it came about.
Sure.
And the story behind it.
Yeah. So I had no problem finding bathrooms, basically. And then I had kids. And I recognized by the time I had, so my girls were about 3 and 1, and I recognized that all of a sudden my relationship to public bathrooms had changed because my, quote unquote, my bathroom need was different. All of a sudden I had somebody who was toilet training. Mm. And that meant that I would be in a park or on a downtown street or anywhere in my city, which I use a lot. I'm a pedestrian. And I would be faced with this, I have to go to the bathroom. That was not me, knowing I could hold it and I could make it and I knew where to go. But a child who was in greater need than I would ever be because she was toilet training. And we had lots of accidents, as every parent listening will understand and know.
Absolutely.
And so I think a lot of the time what we do is just kind of pass these things off as this is what happens. I work as a freelance journalist, and my favorite thing to do in my journalism practice is look at things that we all know but we don't know. Mm. So things that we sort of pass off, don't think about too much, or have this make-do attitude toward. So I started thinking about public bathrooms and thinking about why I was in this position of frequently being out with my girls and having to go home and change clothes, or, you know, just having uncomfortable situations. So I started researching public bathroom access and the politics behind it, and I found this kind of very small but vociferous group of people who were largely in the UK, some in the US, very like none I think at that point in Canada. And so I started looking at the idea that because my public bathroom, my relationship with public bathrooms had changed, my relationship to my city had changed, and I wanted to look at that. So I started out, we're going back here to 2005, 2004. So I wrote a long piece, like a 7,000 word creative nonfiction piece for the Alternative Weekly in Halifax, The Coast. And I looked at all these issues and then sort of set it aside because one does that. But then public bathrooms were kind of the itch I could never scratch. Mm. It just kept coming up, you know, all the time, different needs, different issues. And so when I did my Master of Creative Nonfiction, I needed a topic for a book, and this wasn't my original topic, but then it just sort of hit me that this would be the thing to do. So I did it.
It's amazing, actually. It's come out, this book is coming out right now. I go back to the UK quite a lot, from London originally, and I'm amazed at, and you cover this in your book, how many public toilets have closed.
Yeah.
And there used to be quite a variance from, you know, quite classy places, places, you know, in Kensington and things like that, there'd always be somebody standing in a little half door, and you'd give him or her a tip when you'd go out, and they were lovely, pristine, clean, to the ones in Soho, which were full of needles, and women would just walk straight, prostitutes would walk straight in and stand there at the urinals.
Yeah.
You know, it was absolute madhouse and extremely funny. If you're not intimidated, I'm a big guy and I'm never intimidated by it, but some people were, and guys would not go down there to pee. So they'd have to go into the McDonald's or something like that, and maybe not even be allowed in if they didn't look right or things like that. And you mentioned this all the way through.
I do,
here that there's toilets everywhere, but very, very few can be accessed.
Yeah.
And and everything's closing down. That's partly because of some pressure coming from the side of people who are in wheelchairs and things like that. So sometimes it's a politically correct thing operating where toilets are getting closed down because they don't have wheelchair access.
That's right.
And yet that shuts down everybody else. Very weird.
Yeah. I think there's also the austerity politics that's kind of really strong.
Especially
in the
UK.
Which is causing.
Now, is that happening in Canada too?
So Canada doesn't have a... It is absolutely not the same. We really never had the kind of Victorian pride in public provision that took hold in the UK in the late 19th century, and which kind of, you know, lasted for many, many decades, and really was when a lot of these subterranean, particularly beautiful, you know, which you're talking about, subterranean bathrooms went in. We never had that in Canada. And I'm not quite sure why it didn't stick as much. I'm guessing that... you know, you see those in Toronto, like big, big cities. But Canada's population is quite sparse, so that just, it just really never got to the point, I guess, where municipalities were investing in that kind of infrastructure. And so as a result now, you say you're noticing there's, you know, the closure of public loos. We really never had them, you know, so it's very much a case of people have always relied on the McDonald's.
On the businesses. Bars. So what's the population of Canada these days?
Oh, gosh, you're putting me on the
spot. Over 30 million. Right?
It is over 30.
But not much over. It's not 40 yet, right?
It's not.
And it's one of the biggest land masses.
I'm gonna say it's near 40.
Is it near 40?
But we'll have to. Somebody will have to Google.
I should have looked that up. But it's a massive land mass.
And, it's huge.
Only a certain amount of it is used all along the Trans-Canadian Highway and the rest of it.
Yeah. So all the population is kind of in, you know, very close
the
to coasts, the U.S. border
and along the border. Yeah.
Not all, but a lot.
But a lot of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
And Britain, of course, is now topped 66 million.
Right.
Which is double
in a greatly larger.
In a space about not much bigger than Minnesota.
Yeah.
So it's understandable what you say that didn't really take off in Canada.
And yet it's not.
Well, right? It's not understandable in the US.
Right.
It doesn't seem surprising. Some of the things you've written in this book I was very impressed with the amount of research that you've done. A lot of things didn't really surprise me. And I particularly like being a history buff, going back to the Romans.
Yeah.
I was just in Rome fairly recently and went into the Colosseum. And you can see the public toilets there.
Yeah.
And they had a provision for women.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they were very smart and they had good drainage and the rest of it. But you're right, and obviously, there were men designing it, and you look at it and think, I don't know why a woman would want to go in there. Speaking of stadiums, you like this story. I was at a football match many years ago with some quite boisterous women, and they'd had a lot to drink before the football match and the rest of it. This is in the UK. And again, being a fairly large chap, I could kind of bully the other men into not going into the men's toilet while we let the women go in, because there was a line, or like 60 people deep to go into the one woman's toilet.
Yeah.
And then all the guys are all in there standing up, and there's a couple of stalls in it, and not getting used.
Yeah.
And only being used for urinating.
Yeah.
Not defecating.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I just I had a few drinks too, and I just said, boys, just stay out, let the girls go.
Yeah.
And they went in, and they did the business and came out, and it was wonderful. The girls just, everybody clapped.
Yes, of course.
Because guys need to take some control with this, and they need to come in and say, you know what, we need to help the women out of this. Right. We need more loos for women and less for men.
Yeah. So should I lay out for listeners why we have lines of women?
Yes, of course.
Very specifically. So everybody listening will know they've seen public toilet lines, women waiting and waiting. And I will say personally, just like I told the story about my kids, I really didn't question it. You know, there's a section in the book where I talk about being at this community dance as a child, and there's a long lineup for the girls' bathroom, and nobody is in the boys'. The door is open. Everybody can see the toilet. No one makes a move for it. And I peed my pants waiting in this line. It was horrible. And still, I didn't question it. No. But then when I started doing the research, I really figured it out, or I researched other people who had figured it out. So here's the gist of it. When you go into a women's bathroom, women take longer to urinate, longer to empty their bladders. They also are using stalls only, not urinals, so they have more to do. We go in, we lock the lock, and often the locks are misaligned. It's a series of really tiny little micro problems that add to the time. We have to take down clothing, which is more complex than what men do, sit down. Often the seat has pee on it, so you will have to clean the seat before you sit down. Then you are getting toilet paper, which may or may not be there, which is another problem. You get yourself out, you wash your hands, you leave. And so the sort of numbers that float around are it takes men about 45 seconds and women about 96. And then there was another study more recently that came out of Belgium that said 60 to 90 seconds.
Yeah, I saw that.
Women.
It's a good statistic, yeah.
Yeah. So there's that, so you can see right there. Anybody can see how that would make toilet lines. But what also happens is a lot of buildings that are built, like let's say before 1990, most designers of buildings will have mirror bathrooms, men on one side, women on the other, equal floor space. There's the big red flag right there. So where you may fit a stall and six urinals in the men's or seven urinals, you may only fit three or four stalls in the women's. So in fact, women are biologically and for cultural reasons, we also visit the bathroom more frequently, right? We menstruate, we care for children more often than men do or the elderly. We need about double the provision of men, but what we actually get is about half what men get.
So what you also mentioned in the book was the old pay stalls, and which is really economically not fair at all, was it? Because women have to pay to go in a stall, and the men only stall and get the urinals for free.
But you know, we're seeing that today in Paris. In August, there's a story about these urinals being put up for free in Paris.
Yeah.
Which riles me greatly, and it's not because the urinals are there and men are weeing on the street. Like, I don't have a problem with that. What I actually have a problem with is it's rewarding kind of bad behavior in men. Women have to pee just as much. We have to pee more. Yeah.
I always wondered why the piscine, as it's called in French, couldn't be used to women too.
The pissoir.
So I used to run marathons.
Yeah.
And I ran the New York Marathon right after the 9/11.
Yep.
It was in November 3rd, I think it was. And it was packed. A lot of British people.
I wonder if I know what you're going to say. Keep going.
Yes, I bet you do. A lot of British people were running, a lot of South Americans, a lot of Mexicans, because so many British people and Mexicans, people don't know about that. A lot of them were American citizens, but a lot of British people, a high percentage, were in those buildings, and Mexican people. And, a lot of people went and ran it partly because of that.
Yeah.
It was heartbreaking. But one of the things about the British women got running over the, I think it was the Verrazano Straits Bridge, they were pulling down the pence and peeing along the side of the road, and nobody gave a rat's you know what.
Right.
Nobody cared, because we're all runners, everybody's together. That kind of Victorian sense of decorum had completely dropped.
Yeah.
And that's kind of partly the problem here, is this sense of privacy. You say get in the stall and lock the door.
Yeah.
Why?
Right.
There's everybody's women in there.
Yeah.
Who cares?
Yeah. Yeah.
And back to my little story about standing up and letting the women go into the men's bathroom. Nobody cared.
Mm-hmm.
All the guys were happy to let that happen.
Yeah.
And I knew they would be. Otherwise, I wouldn't have done it, probably.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'd get my head beaten in, especially at a football match. But I knew they'd be okay with it, because men, basically, every man will be on your side about this. Nobody would disagree that it needs to happen.
Yeah.
Every man's got women in his life, and he's got a mother and a sister and a daughter and a wife and all these different things, and everybody knows this problem. The issue is, why isn't it starting to get fixed? This is Ian Graham Leeske. I'm speaking with Leslie Lowe about her wonderful book coming out in September, No Place to Go, How Public Toilets Fail Our Private Needs. This is right on radio. And Josh just very usefully gave me the population of Canada, 36.95 million.
There you go.
So that's very good. Thanks, Josh. So, why isn't something happening when clearly men are kind of on board with this, as far as I know?
I think because it's complex. It's actually complex to build a good public bathroom. And so let's set aside women for a minute particularly. Yes, we need parity. And many, many building codes in many, many places actually have parity a law written into the building code, which would mandate, for example, a 3-to-1 ratio in favor of women, or at least a 2-to-1 ratio in favor of women's provision. But older buildings are grandfathered in, so that, you know, nobody has to undertake massive renovations to their bathrooms just because the building code has changed. But there's also the issue of trans individuals who need all gender bathrooms in a lot of cases. Yeah. It would be lovely if I could say a trans woman can go into a women's bathroom, but the reality of that is often trans people face violence and verbal assault. They can face that quite significantly when they go into bathrooms. So in a lot of cases, it's more comfortable for people who are transgender to use an all-gender bathroom, which is also, it's convenient because it works for cisgendered men and women too. You can use an all-gender, I can use an all-gender, anyone can use it. But that's a cost of building that added thing. There's also, how do you build a good bathroom? Is another question, and it's quite complex because some user needs conflict with other users' needs. So there are some feminist toilet activists who say, no, if you're going to put money into bathrooms, you should be putting it into more provision for women, not for all gender options. Kids need to be taken into account. So kids, that's kind of an interesting thing, is there's not changing tables. There's been, you know, I have Google alerts set up, and I'm always getting these alerts for viral videos of, you know, a dad having to change a baby on a disgusting bathroom floor because only the women's has changing facilities for babies. So it ends up that, you know, there's a lot of different user needs. I would guess another one is, since you brought up, you know, the lock, and why do we need to have this, have a, you know, a stall with a lock. There are some people who have periuresis or shy bladder who have massive problems with stalls. Like, how should stalls be designed? They need auditory privacy, or they can't pee in public, or they, you know, they need visual privacy. Like, there's a lot of different issues. And so I think people get kind of bogged down if they start thinking, if somebody thinks, I want to do a good job here, you know, I want to do a good thing, and I want to level the playing field a little bit and create some equity in this, in a bathroom situation. What they get into, if they really start digging in, is like, whoa, I'm actually, I don't even know how to approach this. It's really, really challenging.
Yeah, sure.
So I think that's
you also
things.
Talked in your book about a massive issue of people defecating outside.
Yeah.
And especially, you know, people who don't have access to bathrooms, you know, places that you were talking about, San Francisco.
Yeah.
The whole homeless situation. We've got one occurring right now. It's just building right close by, and not very far across the freeway. A tent city growing up. There's so many homeless people. And the kind of discordant civic responsibility going on there is astounding. Not the least of which is, you know, public defecation and bed bugs and all sorts of horrible things going on like that. And you know, it's something that we've really got to take care of. And I don't understand why not enough is being done about it. Because obviously, when you look at a city like Minneapolis, which is exploding right now, and it's just booming. I mean, toilets are, as you say, they're absolutely a huge part of our society, but they haven't always been.
Yeah, and I haven't seen any outdoor public bathrooms in Minneapolis. I mean, in the short time I've been here, I've seen porta potties.
Lots of porta potties. There are some around, especially in old, you know, station houses and things like that. They're still there, and they've usually around here. They've usually been converted for people in wheelchairs and things like that. So it's a pretty good town.
And are those 24-hour?
Boy, I wouldn't know. No, probably not.
Right. See, that's one of the keys there is when you sort of, there's kind of toilet activists will make a differentiation between a public toilet and a publicly available toilet. And so when you talk about a public toilet, what we're talking about is something that's free, on street, 24 hours or close to it, paid for by the government. Publicly accessible is, you know, Starbucks this summer announced, yes, everybody can come in and use our bathroom. You don't have to be a customer.
Yeah.
We'll see. Because, I mean, they are not going to allow people in if they don't look like they are a customer, let's face it.
That's right. And one of the, you know, having grown up in the world that you just talked about, you know, where the public toilets were everywhere and now beginning to close, the trouble with them was that they were dangerous places to go late at night. And they were open all night. And my God, you took your life into your hands if you'd go down.
Yeah.
Into some of these underground things.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, I could so many things I wanted to talk to you about. But I love being able to talk about bodily fluids on the radio.
Me too.
You've given me an opportunity to do that, but I didn't have a chance to really get into the other side of it, which is the pooping part, which could have been lots of fun. So we're going to have to leave it at that.
Okay.
But I'd love you to come back with your next book. Come back on the show.
I will.
That was wonderful. Thanks for talking to me.
That's great.
So I was just talking there with Leslie Lowe and her book, which is out September what?
I believe 12th.
September 12th. No Place to Go, How Public Toilets Fail Our Private Needs. Thanks so much for being on Right on Radio, Leslie Lowe.
Thank you.
And now this.